From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on July 23, 1967, in Fairport, New York. Philip Seymour Hoffman was born that day more than 46 years ago now. It wasn't until the 1990s that the world would see just how talented this young man was. Hoffman liked to point out that he was stocking store shelves in a grocery store just trying to pay his bills when he finally got an acting break. It was 1992, and yes, in 1991, Hoffman had earned a part as a defendant on an episode of Law & Order. Hadn't paid much, but it was a start. Now in 1992, he had his chance. A role in the movie Scent of a Woman. That's all he needed for the next 21 years. Philip Seymour Hoffman would put together an acting career with arguably the most diverse list of roles ever. Yes, he played the awkward, idiosyncratic characters often and beautifully well. Music journalist Lester Bangs in the movie Almost Famous, for example, and Hoffman earned the Best Actor Oscar for his marvelous portrayal of Truman Capote. He was also a Major League Baseball manager in Moneyball, an obsessed preacher in Cold Mountain, a villainous international arms dealer in Mission Impossible 3, a character named Plutarch Heavensby in the Hunger Games series. And Hoffman loved the stage, consistently working in theater and taking on such roles as Iago in Shakespeare's Othello and Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman, among others. We could go on. The list of his acting roles is very long, and the list of his awards nominations is even longer. You could not pigeonhole Philip Seymour Hoffman. He could do it all, and he did. But it seemed that he still had so much more to give us, and that's why we were shocked to learn yesterday that Philip Seymour Hoffman is gone. Police say that a screenwriter who was concerned about Hoffman went to his apartment and found him alone and unresponsive, with a syringe in his arm and empty bags of heroin nearby. Police believe those bags, again, contained heroin, perhaps cut with other substances. Well, this hour, we want to hear from you. Join the conversation, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. For the Hour on Connections, we remember the career of Philip Seymour Hoffman with the film critic and writer Jack Garner. Jack, it's great to have you here. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan. It's good to be here and talking about a great actor.
Well, and we're going to hear a lot of clips, but before we jump into the clips, you wrote a beautiful piece in the Democrat and Chronicle, and if you haven't read Jack's piece yet, it's easy to find and you ought to check it out. What stands out first to you among all others about Philip Seymour Hoffman?
Amazing talent as an actor. I mean, but this really hits us on three levels, I think, here in this community. Number one is, if you love the arts, you have these amazing performances. I feel so blessed to have seen him on stage. I saw his Jamie Tyrone in Long Day's Journey Into Night, and I'll never forget it. But his film performances, which thank God are always going to be with us. I remember when Fred Astaire died, I wrote a little thing that says, well, he's going to dance in my living room tonight. And Phil will be acting in our living rooms for some time to come. So that's the solace of the art, and the art lives on after the artist dies. But that's one level, of course. The second level is that he's a Rochesterian. We're very proud of him. From Rochester, and we just we feel sorry, as it's a kind of a community loss in that sense. And the third thing is, I know his mother Marilyn O'Connor very well, and I really love her, and Gordy, his brother, and other family members, and I feel so much pain for them. So it hits us on so many levels.
He was a master at the understated, but also the intensity as well. I'm no film critic like Jack is, and so much of what I know about film I've learned from reading Jack Garner. But I always thought Jack, he was whatever it needed to be, and he never overdid the understated parts, but he wasn't afraid to pour all of the emotion into the strong, moving parts. It was a great range to me.
No, you're right. Absolutely right about that. A range in terms of types of characters and range of emotional depth within those characters. He could go to the darkest places I've ever seen an actor go to. I mean, there's, sometimes people say, well, that's such a daring performance. Well, I'm sorry, digging a ditch is daring work. But
yeah.
But I'm saying in his case, in terms of emotional level, he did indeed go to some very daring places. He also had, he wasn't a vain guy at all. I mean, you could even just look at the guy, loan me a comb. he was a disheveled kind of a guy. He just said, I want to be comfortable. He wasn't in any way a star in the sense of wanting to adapt the trappings of a star. He could have been, but he isn't. He was an actor, and he cared about that in so many ways. He had great passion for the art, and that's why we do independent films and occasionally do a popcorn film, because it was fun and maybe helps with the paychecks. But generally speaking, he'd do independent work and do stage work, not just the Broadway stuff, but off Broadway. He cared about acting. He cared about finding performances that were worthy of really investigating and worthy of going to those dark corners. You know, his mother, Marilyn, once told me, and I've said this before on other interviews over the last couple of days, that he, what she loved about him is that he, even in the really darkest roles, like this guy he played in Happiness, which was, I think, the darkest thing he ever played, she said, Philip, you give voice to the voiceless. And that's a wonderful thing to say about a person, because they do deserve to have a voice. We do need to understand characters of all sorts, because they populate our world.
I wonder, let's listen to the first clip. It's going to be from the first clip from Capote that we have. And I wonder if there is a risk to this, Jack, because he was already known as a tremendous character actor. To take a lead role for someone who is well known, to have to get the voice pretty well, to get the character pretty well. Before we listen to this, was there a risk there that if this didn't go well, people would be saying, why take a lead with that when you're so much better with fictional roles and character acting?
He was scared to death of that role.
He
tried to back away several times, but he knew these two guys, the guy who wrote it and the guy who directed it, who went to camp with him when he was in high school. They went to a theater camp. They got to know each other really well, and they kept pushing him. One of his problems, besides just the daringness of playing a real guy, was that he literally had to shrink. He's a big guy. You know, Phil was probably six even. I don't know, big guy. And he was heavy. And he had to play this tiny little guy. Now, you do some of that by having oversized sport coats and I don't know what all. You know, you do clothing and things and camera angles. But and we all know, of course, he had to do that helium voice, which he did do. But he made us believe it, or at least not care, that he wasn't exactly the same size as Truman Capote. And so he eventually took it on because they were good friends who pushed him. And he got rewarded with an Academy Award.
Let's listen to this first clip. This is Philip Seymour Hoffman in Capote.
I'd only just handed them the final scene when the bellhop told me I had a phone call. And it was my stepfather, Joe Capote, calling to say that my mother had died. I flew home to New York, terribly distraught. But when I got to the apartment, I could see that Joe was in even worse shape than I was. He grabbed my hand and he said to me, "Talk." He'd talk about anything, you know? I mean, any subject in the world. Don't worry whether it'll interest me or not. Just talk.
Again, that's not a scene of thundering and yelling, and yet the intensity there is hard to even really describe, isn't
it? Well, that pause. I mean, the one pause, we both were sitting there saying, is the tape over? We're getting nervous, you know? Of course, you're watching him, you know it's not over, but still... The daringness, it sounds weird, but the daringness of those pauses. You know, I'm taking my time because this is what I'm feeling. And it was amazing.
I imagine that the script may call for a gentle pause there, but a lot of that's probably his own instinct, right?
Oh, yeah, I think so. You know, I think very much so. And I think that's why the actors or the director and the filmmaker wanted him, because of what he would bring. You don't hire him to just be rote. You know?
The second Capote clip is actually... Capote. This is on the Dick Cavett Show, and it's just a shorter clip just for the sake of comparison, because the voice was pretty darn good Philip Seymour Hoffman did. This is actually Capote. Let's listen.
And at the end of the day, he can take two or three drinks and something in it loosens him up, and so that he can go through what he's done and suddenly get a kind of inspiration in his rewriting.
The voice is great, isn't it?
Pass the helium. Yes. Yeah, it's amazing. He got it absolutely perfectly. And that's the other thing that's risky, because not only you want to make sure you get it right, but are people going to be laughing? You know, when every time you do anything that's extreme, I'm sure you felt some of that when you did Flawless, where I played a drag queen. You know, again, you're taking huge risks because you could look foolish. You know?
263-WXXI, 263-9994. We're remembering the career of Philip Seymour Hoffman with Jack Garner for the hour, and we'd love to hear your recollections on either what you thought were maybe the best roles or what you might miss most about a guy who's dead at the age of 46. And despite a remarkably diverse career that we'll, as Jack poignantly said, will still be playing in our living rooms for a long, long time to come. Timeless, really. Mm-hmm. There still seemed so much more that was... capably out there. The next clip I want to get to is one of my favorites. And Jack, you mentioned this in your column. Before we listen to this, explain to the audience who he played in Almost Famous.
In Almost Famous, he played a guy who hardcore rock fans like myself would know if you read magazines. He was especially in a magazine called Cream. He wasn't in Rolling Stone so much. The guy's name was Lester Bangs. And he was a kind of a cynical observer of the rock scene. And the film, you may remember, is about a young boy based on Cameron Crowe's own true experiences, whereas before he even broke 20, I think he was like 16 or 17, he like went on the road with like the Allman Brothers and all these kind of guys and wrote stories. And he went to Lester for a little advice on how do you be a rock critic.
And this is a scene from the movie where they're on the phone together, and the young writer is essentially realizing that, you know, I thought I was in with these guys. I thought I was cool with them. And Lester is advising him on what it truly means to be cool or uncool. So the young child, and then you've got Philip Seymour Hoffman playing Lester Bangs. Let's listen.
Because they make you feel cool. And hey, I met you. You are not cool.
I know. Even when I thought I was, I knew I wasn't.
Right, because we are uncool. Now, while women will always be a problem for guys like us, most of the great art in the world is about that very problem. Good-looking people, they got no spine. Their art never lasts. Then they get the girls. But we're smarter.
Yeah, I can really see that now.
Yeah, because great art is about, you know, guilt and longing and, you know, love disguised as sex and sex disguised as love. Hey, let's face it. Yeah, you got a big head start.
I'm glad you were home.
I'm always home. I'm uncool.
Me too.
You're doing great. You know, the only true currency in this bankrupt world is what you share with someone else when you're uncool. Is that my advice to you? And I know you think these guys are your friends. If you want to be a true friend to them, be honest and unmerciful.
How good is that, Jack?
He's talking about Philip Seymour Hoffman. I mean, that's what's amazing about this sequence, which I, quite frankly, had forgotten about. I'm so glad you played it. That he's talking about the kind of guy he was as an actor. You know, he never went to the opening of envelopes. He didn't care about the trappings of a star.
The red carpet.
None of that crap. I mean, he did what he had to do to help promote a film because he wanted the film to get out there. But he didn't want anybody carrying baggage into the films. They would see a Phil Hoffman performance, and they would see the character. They wouldn't see, oh, I remember I saw Phil was at some party in Hollywood last week or whatever. He was on the cover of People magazine. Well, no, he really wasn't. So that in this great scene from Lester Bangs is telling the kid kind of the same thing. We are not the cool people, but we tell the truth and you tell it fiercely. And he sure did that.
And he delivered a line there that I think a friend of mine, and who I hope will join us later when we get ready to preview the Oscars, Mike DiGiorgio. Mike loves the line and pointed out the line that he said, "The only currency in this bankrupt world is what we say to one another when we're uncool." Mm-hmm. That line, you've got to really be in the character to nail a line like that, because otherwise it can sound a little clunky and cliche, but you're sitting there listening to it, and I am believing it.
Right, exactly right. Yeah, he took a chance with something that could have been laughable, and yet it was right on the money, and he made it very truthful.
You mentioned in your column, we're talking to Jack Garner, and in his Democrat and Chronicle column, looking back at the career and writing a very difficult piece about the death and the life of Philip Seymour Hoffman. You mentioned that he didn't do a whole lot of popcorn films, and probably sometimes to pay the bills, sometimes to be fun. Mm-hmm. But I thought, even when he did the popcorn films, I thought, gosh, he's stealing it.
He really
is.
He can never be any. I'm sorry. He just never was bad, and he was never even just okay. He was always very special, and he was so charismatic. I mean, his villain in Mission Impossible 3, you know what's interesting? I'll never forget the end of that film when he gets whacked by that car. He gets killed by spoiler alert. Anyway, he gets hit by this car, and I'm thinking, and it shocked me. You know, most times in a film when a villain buys the farm, you maybe say, well, yeah, good, you know, move on, let's go, we got him. I was really shocked. Not hurt, he deserved it, but I was shocked because it just, I felt him as a real person in a lot of ways. And when I haven't seen the Hunger Games thing he does, but I'm sure it's fascinating, and I'm curious to see it now especially. I know one has been out, one is coming out, and then there was a third one that he was working on, which was going to be the fourth one, and I think... I read a piece today in The Guardian in England that said that he was only had 5 days left, so maybe they'll be able to make that last one work too. I don't know.
Jack mentioned Mission Impossible 3. Let's listen to a clip from Mission Impossible 3. Philip Seymour Hoffman played an international arms dealer, the villain, and in this scene, again, I did a pretty good job, I think, of pulling profanity-free clips today. In this scene, he is holding a gun to a woman's head with Tom Cruise's character sitting across from him, begging him not to kill the woman. He wants to know from Tom Cruise where the rabbit's foot is. And he's counting to 10, saying, "You don't tell me by 10 and she dies." And this is some of their interaction, Tom Cruise talking to Philip Seymour Hoffman's character. Let's listen.
"I know where the rabbit's foot is. I could help you."
"The way you helped me on the airplane? That way?"
"You put the gun down. I'm not talking to you like this."
"That's your choice. 4.
The rabbit's foot's in Paris. You want to know where in Paris? Then let her go, because you will
it's
never."
"Not in Paris. 5.
He's so intense in that scene. He just says, "It's not in Paris. 5. Mm-hmm. He's going to keep counting. Mm-hmm. Sometimes stars seem to feel the need to overplay a villain.
Right.
And I'm sure you've seen that often over the years, Jack. But Philip Seymour Hoffman never felt the need in that role, at least to my eye, to overplay those scenes.
Not at all. In fact, this reminds me of another great actor who would occasionally do popcorn in a similar kind of a scenario, which was Laurence Olivier in Marathon Man, when he's the dentist and he's drilling Dustin Hoffman's teeth. And he keeps saying, "Is it safe? Is it safe?" And again, he doesn't go histrionic either, you know. And obviously, two great actors in playing villains. But you're right, the silent but deadly, or quiet but deadly, or more deadly.
Was it fun to see him in those big movies, or did it feel at all to you like he was getting away from what had made his career so spectacular?
No. Acting is acting, and I also believe a guy has the right to put some money on, you know, so put some bread on the table. Michael Caine always told me a couple times that he, how's that for name dropping? Michael Caine told me, but he says, I've had a philosophy all my life of do one for them, do one for me, do one for them, do one for me. And if he wants to do off-Broadway, off-Broadway stage productions that cost money and make no money,
yeah,
or if he wants to do films that are unlikely to draw much of a crowd, then he has to occasionally do these films. But you can still approach them with integrity. You can help make sure that the script is good, and that they're fun. I mean, there's a lot of great Hollywood films, and I don't think any of his films are... I don't know of any of his Hollywood films. There's only a handful, but I don't know of any of them that I would say were bad films or were... I mean, he didn't do knock this franchise that much, but he didn't like a Transformers or something. I mean, he did films that he was able to find real characters in and have fun with.
That's a great story from Michael Caine, by the way, and it's mm-hmm. And it's the kind of story that Jack has told so well over the years. And Jack didn't come here asking me to do this, but now is a good time for me to tell our audience that Jack might need to update his book with the passing of Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Right? No, you're right. I have a great chapter in there. I mean, it's great because of him. But I took a lot of 3 or 4 interviews I've done with Phil over the years, and I put them together into a chapter. It's in the book. And I would hate to think that, I'm sorry to have to do this, but I might very well have to put that piece I wrote today in there somewhere.
I think it's going to need to be there, but right. it makes the book even more of a treasure now. It feels so much more immediate and painful, but important. And for the few listeners who don't know the book, Jack, please tell us what the book is and where to get it.
The book is called From My Seat on the Aisle. You can get it at Barnes & Noble. You can get it at the Eastman House bookstore. You can get it at Wegmans, I think. You can get it online at Barnes & Noble and at Amazon. And they're on the verge within a week or two of going Kindle and Nook. So those who like that format, it will be available soon.
Yeah, and that part on Philip Seymour Hoffman is now it's timeless. That's what we have from him is all we will have from him, unfortunately. By the way, this evening, WXXI is going to pay tribute to Philip Seymour Hoffman. Tune in tonight to WXXI-TV for a special encore broadcast of Restoring a Masterpiece. It was produced in 2010, and it was narrated by Philip Seymour Hoffman. You can see Restoring a Masterpiece tonight, 9 o'clock on WXXI-TV. Over the air, channel 21.1, cable channel 11, and digital cable channel 1221. Let's get to our first call of the hour. And by the way, it's 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Ellen is on with Jack Garner. Go ahead, Ellen.
Hi, I have a few memories to share, one of which is really not my memory, but my mother's. She was a teacher at Fairport High School in the English department, did not have Philip Seymour Hoffman as a student, but as a teacher, was taking her classroom to the daytime performance preview of Death of a Salesman, and came home that night and told my father that she was going back to see it again, that this kid was so powerful that she needed to see him a second time.
I mean, isn't it unbelievable? It's like a 16-year-old doing King Lear. I mean, it's,
right.
You know.
And she, when my mother turned 80, we bought her tickets and she saw him on Broadway.
Oh, what a treat.
And had great seats. And then she loved it so much, she said, you have to go. And I went. And that was actually the third time I got to see him on Broadway. I lived in New York for a while. And he and John C. Reilly starred in True West, which has the two-person play and phenomenally physical and fast-moving and incredible dialogue. And what was fascinating for me is that the two actors alternated roles. So when you went to see it, you needed to ask who was playing which role. I saw it before my parents came into New York, I saw it with some friends. And then when they came back and I said they wanted to see it, I made sure we got tickets when they were playing the opposite roles. And they were just incredible characters and just incredible acting.
What an interesting idea. And I'm going to ask Ellen and Jack the same question, because I never saw Philip Seymour Hoffman on stage. And so Jack and Ellen as well, you know, what sometimes we see screen actors do theater, and sometimes very well, but knowing how good Philip Seymour Hoffman was on screen, let me start with you, Ellen, and I want to get Jack's take as well. Was he equally as compelling and his characters equally as rich on stage?
Absolutely. You know, when he was Willie Loman, you forgot that anyone else had ever played it. I saw Dustin Hoffman years ago in Chicago play Willie Loman, and that was a phenomenal performance. You know, you just completely forgot that anyone else had ever walked the stage with that role. He so embodied it. There was just a real, to use an overused word, gravitas, a real presence to him in these roles. And, you know, having seen him in True West, it was a completely different kind of role. And, you know, and then the two roles in that. I mean, he was just riveting.
Great,
yeah. I saw
great stuff, Ellen.
I saw the version of my favorite play in the world, so it was a thrill to see it. His Long Day's Journey into Night, Tom. He played Jamie Tyrone, the older brother, opposite Brian Dennehy and Vanessa Redgrave and Robert Sean Leonard. And in the second act, the brother is a cynic and an alcoholic and kind of a wastrel, and his younger brother admires him. And in the second act, he has this amazing long sequence where he has to try to persuade his adoring brother that I'm not worth it, and it's like a rare moment of reality and clarity and honesty for this brother who normally wouldn't be any of those things. And Philip, I've seen theater for 50 years, and that's, I think it might be the greatest thing I ever saw.
Ellen, thanks for a great call there. We're late for the shortest break in radio. Here's what we're going to do. Quick break. When we come back, the cautionary tale surrounding his death, and then we delve into more film clips from Philip Seymour Hoffman's outstanding career. Jack Garner in studio with us for the hour on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You're listening to member-supported public radio on AM 1370 and FM 91.5 HD2 Rochester.
You don't want to miss Inside Llewyn Davis, continuing this week at The Little. Directed by crowd favorites the Coen brothers, it follows a week in the life of a young musician as he navigates the Greenwich Village folk scene of 1961. Guitar in tow, huddled against the unforgiving New York winter, Davis struggles with his own demons while trying to make it big. USA Today calls it brilliantly acted, gorgeously shot, and altogether captivating. See a full schedule of films at thelittle.org.
Welcome back to Connections with Evan Dawson and Jack Garner, in studio for the hour with us. And Jack, thanks for sharing your time. I know it's a tough day, but at least there is some comfort knowing that his career, while too short, is going to be appreciated for a long time.
You know, it is a short career, but it's a career in which he amassed much more than most actors could ever hope to amass.
What do you think is coming at the Oscars now? They're going to have to be rewriting some of what they planned, aren't they?
That thing where they do the memoriam thing.
Yeah, that will be, I'm sure, a powerful one. Now, he died yesterday morning, was found by a screenwriter friend who was concerned, went to his apartment, and they found him, by all accounts from police now and from multiple sources, with a needle in his arm and some empty bags of heroin there. It was just 4 days before his death. Last Wednesday on this program, we had Jim Wesley, who is the drug section supervisor from the Monroe County Crime Lab, talking about the fact that in western Pennsylvania, 20 people were found dead last week after taking what police called bad heroin. In the words of Jim Wesley, what's happening to heroin now is different. It is being cut with other substances, including fentanyl, which is a drug prescribed to people suffering from cancer, also being cut with caffeine and procaine, and it is highly unpredictable. Drug dealers are cutting it with this stuff to make it more addictive. The problem is, if you don't know what's in there, you can take too much and it can kill you. Here's what Jim Wesley said last Wednesday on this program when I said, how serious is that for someone who's been taking heroin for a long time? Just how dangerous is the current batch?
I would say injecting heroin could kill you. That's basically putting something in your vein could be your last thing you ever do.
And that is eerie, and you hear that now, and you almost wish you could have found a way to get to a guy like Philip Seymour Hoffman and stopped it. But
well, I'm sure a lot of people did try over the years. I mean, you know, I know that his, you know, his partner, you know, struggled with it. His mother, everybody struggled with it, and he himself put himself in therapy. I mean, so he was aware of what was going on. He's a smart guy. You know, there's a tendency, I think, sometimes to think that this is homeless folks or losers or people that aren't real smart. Really smart people, you know. I was a big fan over the years of the great jazz pianist Bill Evans, and he was the Chopin of the piano in jazz. And he had habits, and you know, a lot of other people did. And it's just a tragic thing that it's an illness, and the guy died of a very serious and tragic illness.
Do you think, Jack, that sort of the cliche thinking might have something to it, which says something like, the greatest artists have the most demons?
Well, you know, there is that thing, and it's sort of almost a cliche, and you hear that a lot. And there are a lot of artists. I mean, you can go back to Van Gogh cutting his ear off or whatever. There's a lot of artists that have had psychological troubles and all that. But I think about that a little bit, and I think I know a few people in the business who are great actors who I think, for everything we can see, are just really wonderful, level-headed people. Tom Hanks, for openers. How many Oscars has he been nominated for and won or whatever? And he's a great actor. But he seems level-headed, so I don't think you have to be a tortured soul to create art. However, you know, there are some that do use it as a way to create art, and they have these troubles. So I don't know the answer to that.
I think it's almost dangerous to accept that because, I think we've got to find a way to help people who have addiction and have needs. And I know Philip Seymour Hoffman, as you said, he knew it, and he tried to get help, and he's gone through rehab, and unfortunately, it did not end.
But you know, another thing about the idea of the artist having to be a troubled soul. If we say that, that's going to limit all those poor people, all those kids over at SOTA who are studying the arts right now, who I want them to be in the arts because I love the arts. I love what the rewards they give us, and so I don't want to say to them, you know, if you didn't have a troubled life, go be something else.
That's right.
No, that's not right.
I want people who have good home lives and healthy parent and family lives and no drug addiction to still make great art.
Right. And Phil, by the way, had the good family life and all that. There is no way to say what exactly causes this other than this is an evil, evil drug that people push out there and wish we could stop it.
263-WXXI, 263-9994. Jack Garner for the hour here on Connections talking Philip Seymour Hoffman. Let's get back to the clips. I want to play a clip from a movie called Doubt from 2008, and it included Philip Seymour Hoffman as a priest with Meryl Streep, and Meryl Streep was someone who didn't really like the way Philip Seymour Hoffman was preaching, giving sermons, and she also caught on to what she thought was an inappropriate relationship. Jack, it was pretty amazing to see that Philip Seymour Hoffman and Meryl Streep, two great actors, together.
We're talking serious titans here. And I'd seen it on Jeeva, so I knew the play, and I was looking forward to their performances, and they delivered, of course. But it's a, you know, and it's a, the thing about, I love the title Doubt, because that's the bottom line on this thing. This is a Lady or the Tiger kind of ending. It's up to you to decide, did he or didn't he?
And let's listen as she is accusing him further of an inappropriate relationship with a young boy. This is Meryl Streep and Philip Seymour Hoffman in Doubt.
Why do you suspect me? What have I done?
You gave that boy wine, and you let him take the blame.
That's completely untrue. Did you talk to Mr. McGinn?
All McGinn knows is that the boy drank wine. He doesn't know how he came to drink it.
Did his mother have something to add to that?
No.
So that's it?
I am not satisfied.
Ask the boy then.
Why, he'd protect you.
Why would he do that?
Because you have seduced him.
You're insane. You've got it in your head that I corrupted this child after giving him wine, and nothing I say will change that.
That's right.
But this has nothing to do with the wine. Not really. You've had a fundamental mistrust of me before this incident. It was you that warned Sister James to be on the lookout, wasn't it?
That's true.
So you admit it?
Certainly.
Why?
I know people.
I know people.
By the way, what a wonderfully timed thunderbolt. But yeah, it's I know people. But and Philip really did. Both of those actors know people.
And that's the hard part about that movie, as Jack says, is Meryl Streep is telling Philip Seymour Hoffman, I have made a judgment about you,
right,
and nothing is going to change. I've decided that you've done something horrible, and no amount of evidence is going to move me. Later, she grapples with what might be wrong with having that absolutist stance, but we still don't know if she was right or wrong, and maybe that's the power of the storytelling in that, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, that's, and I admire a storyteller who doesn't spoon-feed an ending at you. You know, I mean, some people are upset when they see a film and it doesn't exactly wrap up neat with a bow at the end. But I like that because it plays to our own intelligence and our own judgment and our own thinking, and I like that.
263-WXXI, 263-9994. Let's get back to another clip from a little bit more well-known and a bigger film. We've been talking this hour about the fact that once in a while, Philip Seymour Hoffman would do a bigger ticket movie. And we got a comment from Jenna on Twitter who says, Along Came Polly, that was another popcorn film that was one of my favorites from him. Jack, what did you think of that?
You know, I'm not sure if I even saw that one.
Okay, but just goes to show you, occasionally he did things, I think Ben Stiller in that one.
I might have seen
that.
I think there's a basketball scene in that, as I recall, them playing basketball, but I don't know.
Yeah, and just goes to show you that it wasn't all art house indie stuff from him. And so let's listen to a clip from Charlie Wilson's War. Now, when this movie was being made, a lot of people said, another Tom Hanks film. But I loved this film, and I loved Philip Seymour Hoffman's character. He played a spy. This is a very short scene because I had to get around the profanity. This scene is from the moment when he finds out he's not getting the job that he wanted, and he feels like, I have laid it on the line for this country for years, and now he thought he was getting the short end of it. Let's listen to Philip Seymour Hoffman in this scene.
The Helsinki job was mine.
The Helsinki job was not yours. If it was yours, you'd be in Helsinki.
Alan Wolf stood in this office.
Alan Wolf is no longer the director.
It was on the books.
Alan Wolf is no longer the director of European operations. He does not make those appointments I do.
Promises were made.
Not by me.
I've been with the company for 24 years. I was posted in Greece for 15. Papandreou wins that election if I don't help the junta take him prisoner. I've advised and armed the Hellenic army. I've neutralized champions of communism. I've spent the past 3 years learning Finnish, which should come in handy here in Virginia.
I was listening to that whole scene. I wonder how many takes it took. That was a real tongue twister. I mean, there was a lot of stuff in there. All that stuff he has to say. And holy cow. And he says it fast and he says it mad. It's not easy.
And in that moment, you're not watching Philip Seymour Hoffman. You're watching a coarse, hardworking spy who's furious.
Yeah, exactly.
And I, like, to Jack's point there, you've got to nail every little ounce of it to make me believe it.
Right.
And he did. And by the way, if you want to find that clip on YouTube, it then devolves into a little more profanity and ends with a great scene of him breaking a window, which you will love.
That was a film where I said to myself, well, this guy should do some really great flat-out comedy because he is funny. There was a lot of humor in that thing.
Yeah, he's known for very intense roles, but he could be really funny. Let's get to Kate in Rochester. I'm with Jack Gunner. Thanks for calling, Kate.
Hi. Just have a quick question. Maybe you even covered it. I came in the middle of the show. Do you think they'll dim the lights on Broadway for Philip?
I did say that at some point today. I don't know if it was on here. I'm sorry. I've been doing a lot of interviews. But I do hope they do, and I would hope they would, because, you know, he wasn't just a film star. In fact, his heart was really in the theater, and he did a lot of great theater work. So I hope they will. I can't imagine they won't, but we'll have to find out.
A related question. Who decides that?
I don't know.
That's a good question.
Maybe it's the Screen Actors, not the Screen Actors Guild. What's the theater? But the people that do the Tony, whatever that group's called. Or it could be the theater owners. They must have an organization. I'm not sure how it happens. But I would hope, I got to believe they're going to do that.
Okay,
Well, thanks. Thanks, Kate. We appreciate that. And but again, just another reminder that if they're thinking about dimming the lights on Broadway for a guy who's known more as a screen actor, it just shows you how good he was.
But he also really did love the theater, and he did the theater. He never left the theater. He stayed in New York. He lived in Greenwich Village, right near where he went to school at NYU. And he was loyal to that whole kind of environment of the theater, and he had his own theater company for a while, and he directed a movie called Jack Goes Boating, which was based on a play that he had done at that theater. So you know, he was really he once said, I heard an interview he did with Charlie Rhodes or somebody, in which he said that that the thing about the theater is the immediacy of it. And he says all acting is immediate. I mean, when you show up on a set, it's that day whatever you're doing immediately. And with the film, it is sometimes a challenge to come back the next day and do another take or something, because it's not, you're not the same. And with the theater, it is what it is each performance. Now, granted, it's the second day, the third day, it could get different, but hopefully, you know, it's pretty locked in.
Let's get one more film clip in, and then what I want to do is get to a chunk of his Oscar speech, because Jack Garner, more than most anybody here in the Rochester area, had a chance to not only talk to Philip Seymour Hoffman, but talk to his mother, and knows more about the personal side. We're going to get to that in a minute, but first let's listen to a clip from the movie, a movie called The Master. And Jack, as I understand it, this is a movie that takes a little bit of its plot from Scientology.
It's loosely based on a charismatic leader who gets people and, you know, wraps them up into a program. And so it's somewhat like Scientology. It's very loosely based, though.
He's meeting a character played by Joaquin Phoenix, and that character is a bit of a drunk has had his own issues, but kind of gets drawn into the message that Philip Seymour Hoffman's character is playing. So this is one of their first interactions, and we get to the question of what is it that you really do? Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, the Master, has to answer that. Let's listen.
You've wandered from the proper path, haven't you? These problems you have?
I don't have any problems. I don't know what I told you, but if you have work for me to do, I can do it.
You seem so familiar to me.
Yeah. What do you do?
I do many, many things. I am a writer, a doctor, a nuclear physicist, a theoretical philosopher. But above all, I am a man. Hopelessly inquisitive man, just like you.
Pauses again. The pauses are unbelievable. I mean, maybe it's because we're hearing audio and not seeing it, but the pauses are unbelievable. But yeah, and the way he says the man, you know, and I am a man. He doesn't hit you over the head with it. I am a man. No, he says, I'm a man. I mean, he lets the word have its right amount of impact. Wow, he was a great actor.
And maybe it is because we're not seeing, we're only hearing, but I think that makes the delivery of his performance even more intense and impressive, just hearing the audio, Jack.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. There's an old saw in movies that if you really want to study film, you watch it without sound so you can see the way the acting and, the way the editing and angles and all that stuff. But the same thing could be said if you want to understand acting, maybe it's just good to hear the dialogue.
Got a note here from someone listening online saying that one of their all-time favorite movies is Scent of a Woman. Philip Seymour Hoffman nailed the spoiled brat prep school heavy role, and you go back to 92, and he, like anybody, Philip Seymour Hoffman described himself as stocking shelves in a grocery store just trying to get a gig. And how important was that role to him, Jack?
Oh, it was huge, because he attracted a lot of attention, even though it was a throwaway role for a lot of actors. I mean, a lot of people you wouldn't notice, but you noticed Phil. It was a really good role. I'll tell you a funny quick story. In New York, before things connected for him, he was doing the usual, you know, waiting tables or whatever they do. One of his gigs was he told me this story once. He was a lifeguard at a rooftop swimming pool at a high-end penthouse building in New York. And this one guy kept swimming back and forth every day, and he kind of looked familiar to Phil, but Phil wasn't sure who he was. And Tony went over and he started a conversation with him, and the guy had a very gruff voice. It was Miles Davis. He was Miles Davis's lifeguard. But anyway.
I could listen to the Jack Garner, Philip Seymour Hoffman stories for the rest of the hour, and I think maybe we should do that. Let's play the last clip we have for the hour is from the Oscars. Now, Philip Seymour Hoffman won the Best Actor statue for his work, of course, as Capote. And this is the tail end of his humble and I would say rather short but humble speech. This is Philip Seymour Hoffman at the Oscars.
And my mom's name is Marilyn O'Connor, and she's here tonight. And I'd like, if you see her tonight, to congratulate her. Because she brought up four kids alone, and she deserves a congratulations for that. And we're at the party, Ma, you know. And she took me to my first play, and she stayed up with me and watched the NCAA Final Four. And my passions, her passions became my passions. And, you know, be proud, Mom, because I'm proud of you, and we're here tonight. And it's so good. Thank you.
Wow. That's it. And that's the only time I've ever heard him sound nervous, Jack.
Yeah, he was. I think, well, he was a little nervous, I guess, with the idea. Yeah, that's interesting. That I guess they always seem to be that way when they get that award. I'm not quite sure. But I just love that. And I don't think, I mean, I've been watching the Oscars. I don't think in my conscious memory, which would go back to, I don't know, maybe 51 or 2, I don't think I ever missed the Oscars. And I can never remember a tribute to a parent like that. I mean, some people will say, hi, Mom, or whatever. But that kind of a tribute was so beautiful and so wonderful. And I'm sure that Marilyn will always treasure that. She did raise, I mean, there was a divorce early on. And her father, I worked for Xerox, I think, and I think he's still in town as well. But the mother did keep the children and raise them herself. And she did an amazing job. All four are accomplished in various ways. Gordy is a screenwriter, and there's also two daughters who have done remarkable things as well, and grandchildren now. And so she was always very proud of all that. I'll tell you a funny story, though. And it's not exactly a reflection on Phil as much as it's a reflection on Marilyn. I had it set up at the newspaper that Phil was expected to win, so we thought that was going to happen. So at the newspaper, I had it set up that I had her cell phone number, and I was going to call her the moment Phil won, so that I could get a comment from her about her reaction to Phil winning. So I called the phone number right after the award, and she answers the phone and says, hi, Jack. I says, hey, Marilyn, how you doing? She says, I just kissed George Clooney. Her son just won an Oscar, and she's saying, I just kissed George Clooney. But she was very proud of that Oscar and very proud of Phil all up and down the line, and not just because of an Oscar, but because of the wonderful actor he became. And also that sports stuff is true. I mean, Phil was a big sports fan, too.
There are pictures that you can see of him with his son at the front row tickets at Knicks games. And
right.
He had three kids, 10, 7, and 5, and makes it, a loss is a heavy loss to begin with, but it makes it even more poignant. Let's jump back to the phones. Mel in Rochester, you're on with Jack Garner on Connections. Thanks
Hi.
For calling.
I just wanted to mention his role, Hoffman's role in the Big Lebowski, which was a wonderful Coen Brothers movie, and he just knocked it out of the park. He played the stuffy assistant, and it was just masterful.
Yeah, and he was sort of the calm center in a crazy, wild movie with lots of crazy characters. He wasn't crazy in that film, but he was very good, which reminds me of another film that I love that he was in. He did in Boogie Nights. He played that guy, that was obsessed with Matt Wahlberg, and he gives him a kiss in an embarrassing moment. But later on, for that same director, he made a movie called Magnolia, which was, again, full of these eccentric characters. But he played a character that the only way you can describe him is a guardian angel. He was very sweet to Jason Robards, who was on his deathbed, and he took care of him. He was his caretaker. And the emotional range was off the charts. Amazing.
When you had a chance to talk to him, we didn't see a whole lot of him in the last few years around here, and sort of one of those guys who was very busy and sometimes hard to reach for local media. And everybody's got their own reasons. I mean, just to kind of go off topic, but along those lines, nobody's ever been able to get through to Kristen Wiig, and she's from this area. So
right.
It's just one of those things. But Jack, you were one of the few who had a chance to talk to him a couple of times. How did he strike you away from the screen, just chatting?
Wonderful. I mean, I had a really nice long lunch with him down near his home in Greenwich Village at a restaurant that he frequented. I also talked to him two or three times here and on the phone. And he loved to talk about the art, and I think he liked the fact that I liked to talk about the art. I didn't necessarily care too much about the personal stuff. We'd talk a little bit about it and how's the family kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was always warm about that. And he had fond memories of Rochester, and he talked about the teachers in Fairport and his mother's support and all that sort of thing. And also the Eastman House and all that. And he came back to the Eastman House, and he came back to the film festival here. And so he did a few of those kinds of things. But he never was, again, he wasn't into the media in the sense that he was always a little wary that it was going to get into a star thing. And he wanted you to have no baggage to take into those performances when you watched him work. So he didn't tell you too much. But he also just wanted to be an average Joe whose job happened to be acting. I mean, they talk about it, all these stories that come out in the last 24 hours in his neighborhood about how he'd walk his kids to school and how he'd be on the corner and people could say hello to him and all that sort of stuff. And so he wanted to be an average bloke who also just happened to be perhaps the greatest actor in the world.
I never got the sense that there was some conversation about should he have been a lead more often and things like that. You know, Capote, obviously he was, but I never got the sense that that seemed to matter to him, but I don't know, Jack. What do you know about that?
I don't know whether it did either. I mean, I know there was a little movie called State in Maine. I think David Mamet maybe did that, in which he was the male lead and got the girl, funny enough. But those are rare, and that was a small movie. But he just found the interesting characters and played the interesting characters. Joel Schumacher, who's a great director, who made a lot of films, and he made Flawless with Phil, and he was actually he came here as a student in the days when you'd bring people up from New York for the summer. They called those summertime kids that would come up here. So Joel knew Rochester real well and knew that Phil was from Rochester. And when he directed him in Flawless, I was talking to him, and he said, the thing about Phil is he may not make zillions of dollars on a specific film, and he may not ever get the girl. But he'll work forever.
Yeah, I saw him in a movie called Before the Devil Knows You're Dead with Marissa Tomei. And I thought what I really loved in that movie about him was, I think one of the flaws from my own amateur take on acting is that when you play a guy or a character that is either a villain or rough around the edges, it becomes too black and white and cartoonish and easy to dislike and not very layered or interesting. Mm-hmm. Even when Philip Seymour Hoffman played either a sort of a quote-unquote villain or somebody with those rough sides, he either gave you a reason to either sympathize or like or at least be fascinated by the layering. It wasn't just an easy, simple portrayal of a character. It was always more than that with him, I thought.
No, he really... He wanted to get to the humanity of whoever it was.
Yeah.
I mean, if he ever did Hitler, which would have been ridiculous because he didn't look at all like Hitler, although
he didn't look like
Capote either.
He would have found a way.
But he would have been the villainous, awful figure that we know, but there also would have been some aspect of him that at least he would have been a real person and not just some cardboard cutout, you know, evil thing. And yet you would find him despicable and hate him and wish he'd never lived. But still, there'd be some humanity there. He always found the humanity in even really weird, bad people. But he also played some really beautiful people.
You know? That might be a great way to sum up his legacy. Now is a great time to go home and reread Jack's book, especially the parts on Philip Seymour Hoffman. And if you don't have it, go get it now. Jack Garner's book is more important than ever on a day like today. As is Jack's perspective, you can read his column in the Democrat and Chronicle and online that he had to compiled about Philip Seymour Hoffman, though, Jack, we all wished it was many years in the future.
Exactly true. I would like to have seen his King Lear.
So much that we did get to enjoy from Philip Seymour Hoffman, but have to wonder what we missed out on. That's an unanswerable question. Jack, always great to talk to you. Thanks for spending the hour.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's the great Jack Garner. We're going to see him again before the Oscars, and we're going to talk about, I'm sure we'll talk more about Philip Seymour Hoffman then, but about some other things, and get back to the business of Hollywood then. Take a quick break here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks for joining us, and we've got a very different second hour. More on that in 90 seconds. Stay with us.